Stoked to be here. Good to see your faces. When George asked me, I was like, "Well, I don't feel ready, but yes." So it feels a little bit like skydiving, just committing and jumping out. But yeah, in all honesty, I've been looking forward to this, to just share my journey thus far with you guys, and you already know a lot of it. You've seen a lot of it, so. Here goes. I wanted to start talking about my dad, my original qualifier, and just kind of who he is, what I got from him. My dad is the alcoholic in my life. He went through a couple phases of alcoholism, I'd say. Early on, it was more of like a violent version, more of an aggressive version of alcoholism, where when he'd be drinking, he could be more hostile. And that lasted until, maybe like, I don't know, sixth grade or so for me. And then going into junior high and high school, he entered kind of a more, depressive version of alcoholism, where he was kind of just checked out and more numbed out. And now what I could piece together, like him being more hopeless and lost himself, and the drink kind of, instead of before, in the violence, there was almost like flashes of, you could see what he wanted. Whereas once it got into the depressive version of alcoholism, those desires had kind of been snuffed out by the disease, and he was more checked out and hopeless, you know. And so just working on that in the beginning of where that put me was, some of my earliest desires, earliest cognizant desires were to put the family back together. I could see that Daddy wasn't okay, that Daddy was mad, or that something was the matter, to such a degree to where that was my original obsession, and where the roots of my false identity came from. And my false identity was that little Patrick thinking he's responsible for putting this back together. That was the key, the root of my false identity. Because my true identity, the one that's being revealed in ACA, is that I'm actually just responsible for what's been given to me, what's in my own corner. That's my true identity, and what's coming out now via the program and voicing things and gaining space from the original pain, trauma, and false identity. But in that early home, the small version of me truly thought and strategized that he was responsible, he was going to put it back together. And that manifested itself in like obsessive paying attention to the demeanor of both of my parents, paying attention to what version of my dad was coming home. I remember I lived in a little condo, and I had bunk beds with my younger sister, who's 3 years younger. It's just the two of us. And I remember just always listening to the door, the staircase, and the hallway. It was like I have it mapped in my brain, like to this day, of like knowing, you could know what type of night it was going to be and whether or not I was going to have that like warm fuzzy feeling and being able to go to bed from the door, the staircase, and the hallway. And I guess what that brings to mind was a specific argument that I've done some work around, where my parents had thought that we were asleep, and I was listening to what was going on and taking mental notes. I was probably like six, it escalated to the point of yelling, and their room was across the hallway, and so they're yelling, and my dad's a big guy, And my mom is a pretty small woman, and so that tension was always there. I wouldn't have been able to put words to that as a kid, obviously, but just the knowledge of what my dad was capable of, like his power, especially me being so small. And so I'm listening to this argument grow and escalate, and I'm like crying at this point because they're already like my obsession. You know, this is already, I adore these people. My dad, I adore this man. Like he's still my hero, right? At this point, like he's still all I think about, you know. And so crying, I get out of my bed, walk across the hallway, and stop to the argument. The thing that they were arguing over was it was whether or not my dad could take me to a rodeo. Was the specific contest of the argument. And so I walked in and just stopped the argument and said, hey, I'm not going. And the argument stopped. My parents were shocked to see this like 6-year-old crying, walking in and, basically making like, an adult decision, really, you know, of wanting everything to be okay, seeing a strategy for making it okay, and then carrying out the strategy of okay. And that reinforced me feeling responsible, because in that moment I was like, okay, I just made things okay. You know, it was like blow up argument and I walked in and stopped it. But I also in that claimed loyalty to my mom's side. She didn't want me to go to the rodeo and my dad did. So I claimed loyalty to my mom and felt shame that I had chose my mom. And that began a fissure in my relationship with my dad as well. And just a questioning of manhood, you know, even starting that young. And like, I was 6, so it's like, it's way before like physical manhood takes charge, but I was already putting the concept of what a man was. And at that point, I had just chosen my mother's way. And so there was a lot of confusion there and longing to get back on my dad's good side. So I guess that kind of sets the trajectory a little bit of like where I was coming from, like massive over responsibility, kind of like maybe some grandeur, you know. I think in the book it has that phrase, an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. that like when the first time I read that, I was like, yes, that I identify with that, because it was grander, you know, and it was my fantasy, and I loved that fantasy. I lived in that fantasy. That was my buffer, that I was going to do something to turn it around, to shift it. And so very enmeshed in my parents' relationship early on. And so as a young person, I got straight A's, and wanted to be everyone's favorite, and just was almost like unceasing in my pursuit of that, of like, I'm gonna make everything right, I'm gonna show them that you can do this, you know, that this could turn around. And so that set the course for me to not get in touch with anything that was going on inside, to not get in touch with maybe like just like a child, what a child wants, you know, and that the process of becoming, of like being able to tell an older person, you know, I want to be a hockey player, or I want to be an actor, or that process was severed, because I wasn't thinking about that. I want the family to be okay. I want everyone to be okay. Was growing inside of me. And I guess meanwhile, my mother was in a codependent relationship with a violent alcoholic at that point, and I was around the house. And so I became my mom's confidant. And Yeah, that the damage there is another topic that maybe I'll get to in a little bit, but it was essentially like shaping at that time what men were and what women were, and in my little tiny like upbringing, women were someone that needed my help and someone I say yes to and don't have boundaries with. That's what a woman was just absorb whatever she needs, like just make her okay. Like that's what a woman was. And a man was someone I'm afraid of, and someone I can't trust, and someone who's potentially violent. Those were like the original things. And then there's me trying to put it together, you know? And so I feel like that's a good exposure of like what the soul rupture looked like for me specifically. Was my soul did not have a place. It didn't have like a spot to sit in, to incubate and become, you know? It was lost at that point. All my attention was out here, and the don't talk, don't tell, everything at that point was blocked, you know? Development, soulful, real, authentic development was stopped at that point, and my focus was out here. And ACA, I mean, the reason I love this program is being able to talk about that, being able to witness that is a pretty big shift. Because then I can see that happened, and I can see where I'm still doing that, and it begs the question of like who's still inside, you know? Who am I really? Even just lately, in a meeting recently, I talked about it, like placing bets. Is like, for me, since I didn't know that I had permission to be myself, and I didn't know there was a self to be, you know, and all my craziness was out here trying to be someone else, trying to be who he or she needed, you know, like using that man and woman context that I just used, that's all my romantic relationships, all my friendships, all my work relationships. That's just my way of relating here to myself. That's all of it. And so to push back from that, can be terrifying, because that's a pretty big question of like, is there someone real there to discover and to be and to become? And so I guess a lot of what I'm getting out of this program is it's redefining my understanding of possibility and redefining my understanding of process. I think as a fierce like hero child, savior complex codependent, I wanted guarantees and I wanted fixtures and I wanted answers. And as a true self, I'm settling for possibilities, and I'm finding that that's actually much better, and that I didn't necessarily truly need the answers and the fixtures and the rigidity that I was looking for, you know, and still sometimes look for. Like I got out of a codependent relationship a week ago, you know. I'm always getting out of codependent relationships, but it's like it's always happening. And so, yeah, like the process is still happening, but instead of getting those guaranteed answers, I'm starting to place the bet on possibility that I'm actually endowed with value, and I'm actually endowed with a life that's my own to discover, that's been given to me and is plentiful, that there's a lot of it that's just for me. And so placing that bet on days is like, okay, like I don't, like on days it feels like frustration, on days it feels like anger, it can feel on any given thing, but I'm like, yeah, or to higher power being like, yeah, right, but because I'm in recovery, because I'm listening and I'm hearing of what's going on, I'll place the bet. You know, I make the choice to place the bet on possibility of like, Sure, show me. Yeah, okay, you, like, I actually have a life that's mine. There's a personality for me to become and discover. I'll place the bet. And that's kind of what recovery's looked like lately. And I guess placing the bet would be like, truly saying how I feel on any given occasion, calling someone and expressing my fears would be placing a bet, coming to a meeting and sharing the thing I didn't want to share would be placing a bet. Any time I'm giving myself any little bit of room that the stuff, the promises could possibly have something for me, then there's potential for something to change inside of me. Yeah. Which is cool. But it's interesting where that's taken me lately, most recently, like today, I guess, is I'm sort of pissed that I haven't been paying attention to my own life, you know? Or I haven't been given any heed to my own process. But I'm like, that anger is like really good for me to feel. And to be like, yeah, wait, what? I haven't been like investing in my own, what could happen in my life and my own possibilities, what's available to me. And so I've been letting myself be angry about that. And it's been cool because, my inner child has something to say. You know, he has something to say. So I'm looking forward to what could happen there. What else do I want to share? I guess that's worth sharing. The other piece was, so I feel like I had a sense of spirituality, growing up. My parents, I didn't really know where my parents were, but they put me in like an evangelical Christian elementary school. And so that conundrum, added to my hero complex and my needing to save and rescue complex as a young person, because I literally thought that I knew answers that they needed. You know, it's like just mechanically, it was like, okay, well now, you know, now it's my responsibility to give them the answers. And so I see the weight and the burden that was put on the kid, because the kid was in a false identity already, right? He was already convinced that his world was mom and dad, and that his world was to save the family. So then to have that spiritual component put on him, on the false identity, you know, in the true identity, what it could have looked like was, that the promises in that form of spirituality were for me. You know what I mean? In a true sense, the true self could have received that, because he would have had a place to receive that. Like, oh, those promises are for me to take and to live out and to experience and to practice within and to process. But that's, the true self wasn't active. The false self was active. And so it just added weight and pressure. Which led to me as a high schooler, by 16, just being so burnt out, so done, so furious, but pretending that everything was fine, and still settling for any hint of like the false identity hero getting pat on the back. You know, my mom would say things like, "Wow, you're doing so much better than your sister," or stuff like this. That I was so in need of some sort of affirmation that it would just. And meanwhile, getting nothing from dad, you know, and wanting so badly for dad to be like, good job, son. You're doing so well. And so, what happened out of that was that, that anger, I want to say I just like, I severed the fact that I was in my family, maybe like 15 or 16, I was just like, they're one thing and I'm another thing, you know, and that's fairly, normal for a teenager to go through. But, mine was like the separate self, the divided self of just like, I had shut off, those original heartfelt desires, of the inner child. And so I went into a phase of just being really shut down, really codependent. Basically, whatever woman I was dating, I would just take on her worldview, and my job was to save her, make sure she's happy, and do what she says. You know, basically parent, like she was my new parent. And so, going into college, one relationship failed and then the next, and the kind of the fury, and the rage and the sadness and the despair started to just grow and grow, and I became more destructive, especially relationally. And I went through, 3 or 4, situations where, like the book says, getting that excitement from, chaos or crisis that we helped create. I went through 3 or 4 situations where I was the destructive factor in a relationship and a group, a friend group, that I basically imploded, you know? And there was this sense of satisfaction. It was like, yeah, like the crazy, like furious kid was like lighting the match. And I was doing this with relationships. One of my favorite things to do subconsciously was get a really good job opportunity and then bail. Or find, get into a situation that could possibly really be really good and just get out of it last minute. And there was this like, I don't know, like little pirate or something in me that was just like fueled by this. Like just the madness of screw you, you know. Anarchy. And what that was a kid trying to get mom and dad's attention. It was still that little kid, like, look at me, see me, this hurts. Why don't you look? Why don't you understand that I'm doing this for you? Like what? That little tiny voiceless person trying to get someone's attention of like, look at this, stop. And so that led me to a place of, hurting a lot of people, especially myself, you know, and just being really lost and at the bottom. And so at that point I cut out and I moved to Seattle just to like separate from, the friend group I was in, and found that the same things followed me, you know? And, at that point I kind of like, I had maybe like a recommitment to Jesus moment, you know? I was probably, 24. Yeah, I think it was 23 or 24, and I just like decimated a friend group with infidelity and just self-sabotage, I guess. And so I had this moment of like, well, I need something to help. And so I went up to Seattle for this reason, but was still operating in a false identity and still looking for quick fixes, still unwilling to feel. Looking for answers, strategies, thought patterns, behavioral modification, you know, just doing anything other than feeling the feelings that were down there and getting in touch with a child who was hurt and abandoned and afraid and needed love and a place to process and become into a true identity. So then, I went back into San Luis Obispo and, maybe I'd shrugged off the like, evangelical part of my spirituality. I was like, I'm not one of those Christians or something. You know, I put a different branding on this journey I was on. Which by the way, I found that I was constantly doing rebranding my journey to fit whatever I wanted it to fit. And so I found like another group, that was maybe we'd say loosely Christian is how we could label it. Basically, it was like a listening prayer group. And so we would just get together and we'd just listen. And the premise was, if there's a God, then God loves us and maybe God will have something to say. That was like the loose premise of the group. And so there was actually a decent amount of growth for me in that period because there was a lot of like letting go to just like, okay, anything could be anything and I'll just receive what's going to come. But again, I strategized to use that to fix my life. You know, I always had to be in the driver's seat. And so my new plan was I'm going to like monk out and be this like listening, like little stoic creature in the hills, you know? And that was my new mode until I met a girl who fit all the categories that needed to be fit. She needed to be rescued. She was encouraging and comforting and I needed a mother, you know? And so got back into that, went about 6 months, and was like, that was one of the darkest times because I, at that point I truly thought, there wasn't any help for me. I would say that period, that was right before I moved back to Santa Barbara. That period, was me getting close to suicide. Like suicidal fantasies, were becoming realistic at that point, just in a strategic way of like, I truly felt like I tried everything I could. And so suicide started to become something that I was nurturing at that point as a potential option, you know, and I kind of kept it around in my back pocket. I'm like, well, you know, there's always that, which was a dark, dark place to be. And so breaking up with that girlfriend again, it was severance from the friend group. And this was my new friend group, you know, this was my one that I was like, this will never break. You know, we're listening to God together. This will never break. And that was my new friend group. And so again, I found myself, alone and feeling without a paddle. But this time, and again, I think this is kind of like a higher power circumstance. Right before that breakup, I had, went to my house for the holidays. And I was sitting in my room from high school and I just started weeping and I like had no grid, no recovery at this point, no idea why I was crying. Like I truly at that point might have not said my dad was an alcoholic. I might have said he had a drinking problem or he was mad a lot when I was a kid, but I had no concept of disease, you know, and codependency. I was like, oh, my mom's fine. My mom's version of denial is like just the happy bunny, you know, like nothing, there's nothing negative in the world, like let alone in her life. That's my mom's version. So like, I still would have thought, oh yeah, mom's fine. What do you mean? Mom's fine. But I'm sitting in my room and I'm weeping and my sister comes in, she was just walking in the hall and I said to her, miss, if things don't change, I'm out of here and I'm never coming back. And it was like we had never had a talk like that, you know, so she didn't know what was happening. I didn't know what was happening. And then I go out and I tell my mom, hey mom, I just need to go. I didn't say anything else. I was just like, I need to go right now. I'm going back to Matt's house in San Luis Obispo. I need to go right now. Like I'm not staying for dinner. And then my mom starts crying and she grabs a hold of me and goes, no, don't go. Not like this. Not like, and this is the woman that, like I said before, it's like, I've never seen her be emotional. She's screaming, not like this, don't go, like holding on to me like this. And again, at the time, no recovery, no real understanding of what's going on. But I look back now and see how that was affirming my role in the household and what my child carried, who he was, to my mom and to the dynamic of like, to pull out on that, it took a lot. It took me being in a lot of ACA meetings and having support to pull out of that role and understand that I could have a life of my own that wasn't in that enmeshment. Anyways, that was before recovery. So I quit my job in San Luis Obispo and move home after that interaction. I left, like, I had sort of sabotaged a degree I was working on, and so I was up there, and I felt pretty aimless anyways, so I went back to my original mission, you know, the original childhood mission of putting the family together went, was manifest in Santa Barbara this time, as this was 4 years ago, 3 years ago. So this time I was an adult, but I was literally like, it was like I was going to fix the family again. You know, the original one was back. All the other ones that I'd sabotaged trying to get their attention, I was actually in the household. And it was hell for my soul. Like that period, I look back at like logically, you know, I look back and I was like, what are you doing? But spiritually, I know exactly what was going on. I was going back to see where I'd come from and to get to the roots of why I was so sick and why I couldn't make any of my own decisions and why I was constantly looking for something or someone to numb out on. I was like, I was coming into contact with the roots of that. But still just had no idea how to deal with that, until, coming to ACA. And hearing a description of what I was going through that hadn't come from me. Hearing a description of my life that I didn't come up with, and I didn't brand it, and I didn't give it a new schnazzy label. You know, I didn't have any part in like discovering the words that they were saying, and I was identifying more than any of the false identities I'd tried on my whole life, trying to put something together that works. And so it's like being found out like that started a process in which I had to come into terms with what I've been through. And then as a bonus, getting the 12 steps, and getting a people to practice the 12 steps with, it's like now I have something to work on, because I'm still doing all the things, you know, like the traits are still active. I'm just as sick as I always have been, except I'm recovering. And now when I relapse, I have a place to go. And when I relapse and when I do something that's in my false identity, and it's like that's part of the funny thing about recovery is you start to realize when you do things in your false identity, you're like, wow, this is totally not me, but I'm still doing it. But now I have an anchor to throw, you know? I got a phone call to make. And I can begin to work on what's actually going on and get in touch with a reality that's mine. Which is scary, right? Because I didn't know that I had one. the conundrum is still inside of me, but I'm closer to it than I ever have been. And I'm able to sit and stay and feel it and get in touch with all of the emotions around it, which begins to flow. And like I start to think that that I'm worth it, right? That there's value just in my existence, and I get to start there. Yeah. I think if there's anything else I want to touch on. I think that's it, you guys. I think that's my share for tonight. So thank you very much.